The screaming of tortured metal still echoed in my skull as I dragged myself from the wreckage of the Mordians' vengeance. My uniform hung in tatters, soaked with blood that wasn't entirely my own, and every breath sent razor-sharp pain through my ribs. The transport vessel that had carried me and 300 souls lay scattered across a kilometer of blackened earth, her hull cracked open like a rotten fruit. I spat blood and tasted the bitter tang of the rebreather mask that had saved my life. The Geller field collapse during warp translation had been catastrophic. Reality had twisted around us for what felt like hours before we were spat back into real space above this emperor-forsaken rock. The pilot had managed one final act of service before the bridge section separated from the rest of the ship, bringing us down in a barely controlled crash that turned most of my crew into paste against bulkheads. Standing amid the debris field, I surveyed what remained of my command. Twisted chunks of adamantium plating jutted from the ground at impossible angles. Bodies hung from the skeletal framework like grotesque ornaments, their faces frozen in expressions of terror that spoke of what they had witnessed during our passage through the warp. The acrid stench of burning promethium mixed with something far worse, the sweet corruption that clung to anything touched by the immaterium. The sky above Morty's Tertius was the color of old blood, streaked with veins of sickly yellow that pulsed with their own malevolent light. Two suns hung in that diseased firmament, their combined radiance casting everything in harsh, unnatural shadows that seemed to writhe when I wasn't looking directly at them. The air itself felt wrong, thick with particulates that made my rebreather work overtime to filter out whatever toxins saturated this world's atmosphere. I began my survey of the crash site, stepping carefully around the larger pieces of wreckage. The Vox unit from the bridge section had somehow survived intact, though its machine spirit flickered weakly. Static filled the channels, but occasionally I caught fragments of transmissions, garbled voices speaking in dialects I didn't recognize, punctuated by sounds that made my skin crawl. The landscape beyond the crash site stretched out in all directions like a vision of damnation itself. Massive craters pockmarked the surface, some so deep their bottoms disappeared into absolute darkness. Between them, the skeletal remains of Titan war machines rose like monuments to futility. A Warlord-class engine lay on its side perhaps 2 kilometers to the east, its void shields long since failed, its armor plates peeled back to reveal the corrupted flesh that had once been its crew. Smaller war engines dotted the terrain, warhounds and reavers reduced to scrap metal and bone, their weapon systems melted into abstract sculptures of destruction. The ground itself seemed diseased. What might once have been fertile soil now resembled a carpet of ash mixed with something that looked disturbingly organic. Strange growths pushed up through the surface in places, not quite plant, not quite flesh, but something that combined the worst aspects of both. They pulsed with a rhythm that reminded me uncomfortably of a heartbeat, and when the wind shifted, they released spores that made my rebreather's filtration system work even harder. I had been walking for perhaps an hour when I spotted the first signs of human habitation. Smoke rose from what appeared to be a fortified position built into the remains of a crashed Thunderhawk gunship. The aircraft had been stripped of anything useful, its hull plating repurposed into makeshift walls and barriers. Razor wire had been strung between twisted support struts, and I could make out the distinctive silhouettes of heavy weapons emplacements covering the approaches. As I drew closer, figures emerged from concealment with the practiced efficiency of soldiers who had learned to trust nothing and no one. They wore the tattered remains of Imperial Guard uniforms, though the regimental insignia had been obscured by grime, blood, and makeshift repairs. Their faces were gaunt, eyes sunken deep into skulls that spoke of prolonged malnutrition and constant stress. Each man carried his lasgun with the careful attention of someone who knew that ammunition was precious and every shot might be his last. The apparent leader stepped forward, his movements betraying the nervous energy of a man who had seen too much and slept too little. His uniform bore the remnants of sergeant's stripes, though they were barely visible beneath layers of accumulated filth. When he spoke, his voice carried the harsh rasp of someone whose throat had been damaged by the toxic atmosphere, despite the crude rebreather mask he wore. He identified his unit as what remained of the 47th Valhallan Ice Guard Regiment, though the cold weather gear that had once defined them now hung in useless tatters. They had been part of the Imperial Reconquest Force that had arrived over 2 years ago, only to find themselves trapped when the fleet was forced to withdraw. The local PDF forces had joined them after their command structure collapsed, creating this ragged band of survivors who had somehow managed to avoid the fate that had claimed so many others. The sergeant's account of their situation painted a picture of systematic horror that had unfolded over months. The reconquest had begun well enough. Orbital bombardments had cleared the major population centers of obvious chaos corruption, and the initial landings had met only token resistance. It was only after the ground forces had spread out across the continent that the true nature of the threat became apparent. Chaos cultists had indeed been active on Mortis Tertius, but their corruption ran far deeper than simple heretical worship. They had successfully completed a summoning ritual of unprecedented scale, calling forth a greater demon whose very presence had begun to warp reality itself. The Imperial response had been swift and brutal. Entire city blocks had been reduced to glass by orbital lance strikes, and Titan legions had walked across the surface like avatars of the Emperor's wrath. But the damage had already been done. The demon's manifestation had torn holes in the fabric of reality that persisted even after its banishment back to the warp. These wounds leaked corruption into the physical world, creating zones where the laws of physics became suggestions and madness took on tangible form. The shadows themselves had become predatory entities that hunted anything with a soul, while whispers in long-dead languages echoed from empty air, driving men to acts of violence against their own comrades. The sergeant described how entire companies had simply vanished overnight, leaving behind only empty uniforms and weapons scattered on the ground. Others had been found days later, their bodies intact but their minds completely shattered, babbling about things they had seen in the spaces between heartbeats. The lucky ones had simply put their service pistols to their temples and pulled the trigger. The survivors had learned to move only during the brief periods when both suns were visible, as the darkness brought with it manifestations that defied description. They had developed crude rituals of their own, not the heretical practices of chaos worship, but desperate attempts to ward off the attention of things that should not exist. Salt lines drawn around sleeping areas, iron fragments sewn into clothing, constant recitation of imperial prayers that had been modified through trial and error to provide some small measure of protection. Their leader went on to explain how the corruption manifested in different ways across the planet's surface. Some areas were plagued by temporal distortions where minutes stretched into hours or compressed into seconds without warning. Others experienced gravity fluctuations that could crush a man flat or send him floating helplessly into the poison sky. The worst zones were those where reality itself had become unstable, creating pockets where the physical world bled into the immaterium without the protection of a Geller field. The psychological toll had been perhaps even worse than the physical dangers. Men who had survived decades of warfare across the galaxy found themselves reduced to gibbering wrecks by exposure to sights that their minds simply could not process. The constant stress of never knowing whether the ground beneath their feet would remain solid or whether the air they breathed would suddenly turn to acid had pushed many beyond the breaking point. They had tried to establish contact with the fleet, but the atmospheric corruption interfered with long-range Vox transmissions, turning them into carriers of the same whispers that plagued the surface. Several operators had been driven mad by prolonged exposure to the static-filled channels, claiming that voices from the warp were speaking directly into their minds through the communication equipment. The survivors had learned to recognize the signs of impending manifestations, a sudden drop in temperature, the way shadows would begin to move independently of their sources, or the metallic taste that filled the air just before reality began to fray at the edges. They had developed a crude early warning system using salvaged Auspex units, though the readings were often contradictory and sometimes showed contacts that weren't there or failed to detect threats that were all too real. Food and water had become constant concerns, as the corruption had rendered most local sources toxic. They survived on dwindling supplies of ration packs and recycled atmospheric moisture, supplemented by whatever could be scavenged from the endless debris fields that covered the planet's surface. Medical supplies were virtually non-existent, and injuries that would have been minor inconveniences in a proper imperial facility became potential death sentences in this environment. The most disturbing aspect of their account was how the corruption seemed to be spreading, growing stronger with each passing day. Areas that had been relatively safe during the early months of their isolation had gradually become uninhabitable as the reality wounds expanded and multiplied. The survivors found themselves constantly retreating, abandoning carefully prepared positions as they became untenable, always moving but never truly escaping the influence that permeated this cursed world. As I listened to their grim recitation of survival against impossible odds, I began to understand that my crash landing had not been the random misfortune I had initially assumed. The same forces that had destroyed the Reconquest fleet and trapped these men were still active, still growing in power, and my arrival had simply added one more soul to their collection of the damned. The first signs of deterioration among the survivors became apparent within days of my arrival at their makeshift stronghold. Trooper Kellish, a veteran who had served with distinction during the initial landings, began exhibiting behaviors that set my teeth on edge. He would stand motionless for hours at a time, staring at sections of empty air as if watching something the rest of us could not perceive. When questioned about his vigil, he would explain in matter-of-fact tones that he was monitoring the movements of figures that walked just beyond the edge of vision, always staying in his peripheral sight, but vanishing the moment he turned to look directly at them. The sergeant dismissed these episodes as battle fatigue, but I had witnessed enough warp exposure during my naval service to recognize the early stages of psychic contamination. Kellish's condition worsened rapidly. He began scratching at his arms with increasing intensity, leaving deep gouges in his flesh that he claimed were necessary to remove the insects burrowing beneath his skin. The wounds never seemed to heal properly in this poisoned atmosphere, instead developing into weeping sores that attracted clouds of the native flies, grotesque things with too many wings and eyes that glowed with their own sickly light. Within a week, Kellish had carved symbols into his forearms with his combat knife, geometric patterns that hurt to look at directly. He insisted these markings were protective wards, though they bore no resemblance to any imperial iconography I recognized. The other survivors gave him increasingly wide berth, but none were willing to restrain a man who still maintained his watch duties and could handle a lasgun with steady hands. The breaking point came when Kellish attacked Corporal Vex during the night watch, claiming that the man's shadow had begun moving independently and was trying to strangle him. The fight was brief but vicious, ending only when three other troopers managed to subdue Kellish and bind him with salvaged cable. He spent the remainder of that night screaming about things crawling inside his skull, his voice growing increasingly hoarse until it became nothing more than a rasping whisper that somehow carried further than his earlier shouts. By morning, Kellish had chewed through his own tongue in an apparent attempt to prevent himself from speaking words he claimed were not his own. The sight of him lying in his own blood, eyes rolled back to show only the whites, finally convinced the sergeant that something beyond simple madness was affecting his men. We dragged Kellish's body outside the perimeter and burned it with the last of our Promethium reserves, though the flames burned with colors that should not exist, and the smoke formed shapes that resembled screaming faces. The incident with Kellish proved to be merely the beginning. Other members of the unit began displaying similar symptoms with increasing frequency. Trooper Mensk developed an obsession with counting, spending entire days numbering the pieces of debris around our position and becoming violently agitated when anyone disturbed his tallies. He claimed that maintaining an accurate count was the only thing preventing reality from unraveling completely, and that each misplaced fragment brought them closer to total dissolution. Guardsman Holt began experiencing episodes where he would suddenly freeze mid-sentence, his eyes unfocusing as if he were listening to voices only he could hear. These episodes grew longer and more frequent, sometimes lasting for hours while his body remained rigid as a statue. When he finally returned to awareness, he would have no memory of the lost time, but would often be found holding objects he had no recollection of picking up, fragments of bone, pieces of corroded metal, or stones that felt unnaturally warm to the touch. The most disturbing case was Sergeant Thorne, the unit's former medic, who had begun performing crude surgical procedures on himself using salvaged medical instruments. He claimed that something was growing inside his abdomen and that he needed to remove it before it could mature. His attempts at self-surgery had left him with a network of poorly healed scars across his torso, each one marking another failed attempt to extract whatever he believed was gestating within his body. Despite the obvious pain these procedures caused him, Thorne continued his work with single-minded determination, his hands remarkably steady even as his sanity crumbled. My exploration of the surrounding area during scavenging missions revealed the true scope of the catastrophe that had befallen this world. Hidden beneath collapsed structures and concealed by the ever-present ash drifts, I discovered the first of many mass burial sites that dotted the landscape like pustules on diseased flesh. The graves were crude affairs, little more than trenches scraped from the hardpan earth and filled with layer upon layer of human remains. The bodies showed signs of systematic execution, single las bolt wounds to the back of the head, precise and uniform in their placement. These were not the chaotic casualties of battle, but the methodical elimination of a population by their own protectors. Scattered among the corpses were the remnants of civilian clothing, the simple garments of farmers and factory workers who had trusted their planetary defense forces to shield them from the horrors that had consumed their world. The most damning evidence lay in the positioning of the bodies themselves. Families had been forced to kneel together before their execution, parents shielding children who were no longer present in my narrative, the elderly supporting each other in their final moments. The PDF troopers had worked with ruthless efficiency, moving from settlement to settlement in a campaign of extermination that had consumed entire population centers within a matter of weeks. Documentation scattered throughout the burial sites told the story in fragments, requisition orders for additional ammunition, reports of increasing civilian unrest, and finally, the chilling directive that classified the entire planetary population as compromised by chaos taint. The local PDF commander had made the decision to eliminate every living soul on Mortis Tertius rather than risk the corruption spreading beyond the planet's boundaries. What made the discovery even more horrifying was the evidence that the PDF forces had been correct in their assessment. Many of the bodies showed signs of mutation that had begun before their deaths, extra limbs sprouting from torsos, faces that had begun reshaping themselves into inhuman configurations, and growths that defied biological classification. The corruption had indeed taken hold among the civilian population, but the cure had proven far worse than the disease. The mass graves stretched for kilometers in every direction, a testament to the scope of the genocide that had been carried out in the Emperor's name. Conservative estimates suggested that millions of souls had been consigned to these unmarked pits, their only crime being residence on a world that had fallen under the influence of powers beyond human comprehension. The PDF forces themselves lay buried in separate sites, their own corruption having progressed to the point where they had turned their weapons on each other in the final stages of their campaign. Our equipment failures began as minor inconveniences, but quickly escalated into life-threatening malfunctions that seemed to occur at the worst possible moments. The Vox caster that had provided our only link to the outside universe began producing transmissions in languages that predated human civilization, the static-filled channels carrying messages that caused physical pain to anyone who listened for extended periods. Several attempts to repair the unit only made the problem worse, as if the machine's spirit itself had been corrupted by prolonged exposure to the warp-tainted atmosphere. Weapons malfunctions became a daily occurrence, with las guns failing to fire when hostile contacts appeared on our perimeter sensors. The power packs would show full charge readings right up until the moment the trigger was pulled, at which point the weapon would simply refuse to function. Cleaning and maintenance rituals that had served faithfully for decades proved useless against whatever force was interfering with our equipment, and several weapons had to be abandoned entirely after they began producing energy discharges that moved in directions that violated basic physics. Our rations presented their own set of horrors, as sealed containers that should have remained fresh for years showed signs of advanced spoilage despite intact packaging. The nutrient paste inside had taken on colors and textures that suggested biological activity, writhing with movements that were clearly visible through the transparent portions of the containers. The stench that emerged when these packages were opened defied description, a combination of decay, and something else that triggered immediate nausea in anyone who breathed it. Water purification tablets proved equally unreliable, sometimes working as intended, but more often producing liquids that were technically safe to drink, but carried an aftertaste that lingered for days. The purified water would occasionally develop a slight phosphorescent glow in darkness, and consumption of these batches was followed by vivid nightmares that seemed to persist even after waking. Several men reported dreaming the same sequences of images, suggesting that something in the water was creating a form of shared psychic contamination. Scavenging missions into the demon-touched ruins became increasingly desperate affairs as our supplies dwindled to critical levels. The twisted remains of the cities offered potential sources of salvageable materials, but venturing into these areas required careful timing and constant vigilance. The corruption was strongest in places where large numbers of people had died violently, creating zones where reality itself had become unstable and hostile to human presence. The ruins shifted when not directly observed, buildings rearranging themselves into configurations that followed no architectural logic. Streets that led in one direction during daylight would somehow reverse themselves under cover of darkness, creating maze-like conditions that trapped unwary scavengers in endless loops of identical corridors. Several men had been lost to these spatial distortions, their vox signals growing increasingly distant, even as their position readings indicated they were standing mere meters away. The warp-touched environment manifested its corruption in ways that challenged every assumption about the nature of reality. Time itself became unreliable in certain areas, flowing backward in pockets where the dead could be observed rising from their graves and walking in reverse through the moments leading up to their deaths. These temporal anomalies created viewing windows into the final hours of the planet's civilization, allowing horrifying glimpses of the events that had led to the current state of devastation. In one particularly disturbed section of the former capital city, I witnessed the same group of civilians being executed repeatedly, the scene playing out in an endless loop that reset every few minutes. The PDF troopers would march their prisoners to the execution site, deliver the killing shots, then walk backward to their starting positions as the victims rose and returned to life. The cycle continued without variation, a permanent record of atrocity burned into the fabric of space-time itself. The ground throughout these areas had developed a disturbing tendency to blade when disturbed, seeping a dark fluid that was not quite blood, but shared its color and consistency. Digging for salvageable materials became an exercise in horror, as every shovel full of earth revealed more of the viscous liquid, sometimes accompanied by fragments that resembled bone or tissue, but crumbled to ash when exposed to direct sunlight. Plants that had somehow survived the initial catastrophe showed signs of fundamental changes to their basic nature. Trees grew downward into the earth while their roots reached toward the sky, their bark weeping tears of amber that contained the preserved remains of insects that had never existed on this world. Grass grew in perfect geometric patterns that hurt to look at directly, forming symbols that seemed to shift and change when viewed peripherally. The very air in these corrupted zones carried whispers in dead languages, voices that spoke of things that should remain unspoken. Prolonged exposure to these auditory hallucinations produced physical symptoms, nosebleeds, temporary blindness, and a persistent ringing in the ears that sometimes resolved into recognizable words in Gothic. The words were always warnings, descriptions of approaching dangers that materialized with disturbing frequency, as if the voices were providing tactical information to help ensure our survival for reasons of their own. Weather patterns defied meteorological explanation, with rain that fell upward and snow that burned like acid when it touched exposed skin. Wind would sometimes blow from impossible directions, carrying sense of places that existed only in nightmares and the sound of battles being fought in dimensions adjacent to our own. These atmospheric disturbances seemed to follow their own schedule, appearing and disappearing according to rules that remained beyond human comprehension. The psychological toll of constant exposure to these reality distortions could not be overstated. Men who had faced the horrors of galactic warfare without flinching found themselves reduced to trembling wrecks by the simple act of watching their own shadows move independently of their bodies. The knowledge that the fundamental laws governing existence had been suspended created a form of existential terror that wore away its sanity like acid dissolving metal. Sleep became increasingly difficult as the boundary between dreams and waking experience began to blur. Nightmares would intrude into conscious thought, while waking observations would carry the surreal quality of fever dreams. Several men reported experiencing the same recurring vision of standing in a vast cathedral where the walls were made of living flesh and the altar was constructed from the bones of saints whose names had been forgotten by history. The isolation crept upon me like a disease, manifesting first as a nagging awareness that I was becoming the sole anchor of sanity among the survivors. While my companions descended deeper into their respective forms of madness, I found myself forced into the role of unwilling observer, watching men I had come to respect transform into hollow shells of their former selves. Corporal Vex had begun constructing elaborate traps throughout our defensive perimeter, claiming he could hear enemies approaching from directions that existed only in his fractured mind. His snares were works of twisted ingenuity, incorporating salvaged wire and scrap metal into configurations that seemed designed more to maim than kill. When I questioned his methods, he explained with perfect military precision that the screaming of wounded infiltrators would serve as an early warning system, though no enemies had approached our position in weeks. The traps began claiming victims among our own number when Guardsman Holt triggered one during a routine patrol, the improvised device nearly severing his leg at the ankle. As I applied field dressings to the mangled limb, Vex stood nearby nodding with satisfaction, insisting that the trap had functioned exactly as intended because Holt was obviously not who he appeared to be. The accusation hung in the air like poison gas, and I watched the other survivors exchange meaningful glances that spoke of growing paranoia and mistrust. Sleep became a luxury I could no longer afford, as the nights brought with them a symphony of disturbing sounds from my companions. Sergeant Thorne continued his surgical experiments with increasing enthusiasm, the wet sounds of his self-mutilation accompanied by whispered commentary about the progress of his work. Trooper Mensk had developed a habit of rearranging our equipment stores according to patterns that made sense only to him, and any attempt to restore proper organization would send him into violent rages that required physical restraint. The morning I discovered that someone had been tampering with our remaining ammunition supplies marked a turning point in my relationship with the other survivors. Several power packs had been deliberately damaged, their energy cells punctured with surgical precision that rendered them useless. The sabotage was too methodical to be the work of someone completely unhinged, suggesting that at least one member of our group retained enough mental faculties to plan and execute deliberate acts of undermining our collective survival. My attempts to investigate the sabotage met with blank stares and evasive responses that convinced me the perpetrator was still among us, watching and waiting for the next opportunity to strike. Trust evaporated like morning mist under the twin suns, replaced by constant vigilance and the exhausting mental effort required to monitor potential threats from every direction simultaneously. I began sleeping with my last pistol loaded and ready, though I questioned whether I would be able to use it against men who had once been my allies. The decision to venture alone into the Underhive ruins came from desperation rather than courage. Our supplies had reached critical levels, and the increasingly erratic behavior of my companions made group expeditions impossible. The ruins of the former planetary capital stretched across the horizon like a vast necropolis, its twisted spires and collapsed hab blocks offering the promise of salvageable materials for those willing to brave the corruption that saturated every surface. The descent into the underground levels required careful navigation through passages that had been partially collapsed by orbital bombardment. Emergency lighting strips still functioned sporadically, their flickering illumination casting dancing shadows that seemed to move with purpose and intelligence. The air grew thicker as I descended, carrying scents that reminded me of surgical theaters and charnel houses in equal measure. The first chamber I discovered had once served as a storage facility for medical supplies, though the containers had long since been emptied of anything useful. What remained were the bodies of the facility's staff, arranged in neat rows along the walls with their hands folded across their chests in positions of peaceful repose. The preservation was unnaturally perfect, as if death had claimed them only hours before, though the thick layer of dust covering everything suggested they had been dead for months or years. Closer examination revealed that each corpse had been flayed with extraordinary care, their skin removed in single continuous pieces that had been stretched and mounted on the walls like macabre tapestries. The preserved flesh bore intricate patterns carved into its surface, symbols that seemed to writhe and shift when viewed directly. The artistry involved in the work was undeniable, each piece representing hours of meticulous labor by someone with both anatomical knowledge and artistic vision. The arrangement of the bodies themselves followed a pattern that became apparent only when viewed from the chamber's center. They formed concentric circles around a raised platform where additional remains had been positioned in configurations that hurt to contemplate. Arms and legs had been repositioned to create geometric shapes that violated basic principles of human anatomy, while heads had been arranged to face inward toward whatever ritual focus had once occupied the platform's center. Moving deeper into the complex revealed additional chambers, each one containing its own collection of carefully arranged corpses. The work showed clear progression in technique and ambition, as if the unknown artist had been perfecting their craft through repeated practice. Later chambers contained bodies that had been modified extensively before death, surgical alterations that transformed human forms into abstract sculptures of flesh and bone. The scale of the operation became apparent as I explored room after room of preserved remains. Hundreds of bodies had been processed through this facility, each one representing an individual life that had been ended for the sole purpose of serving as raw material for whatever blasphemous project had been conducted here. The systematic nature of the work suggested organization and planning that extended far beyond simple cultist activity. Documentation scattered throughout the facility provided fragments of the larger picture. Medical records indicated that the subjects had been processed while still alive, their deaths occurring only after the completion of whatever procedures had been performed upon them. The clinical language used in the report spoke of experimental protocols and measured results, as if the torture and mutilation had been conducted for research purposes rather than simple sadistic pleasure. The discovery of a sealed chamber deeper in the complex revealed the true purpose behind the extensive preparations I had witnessed. The room contained a single massive symbol carved directly into the floor, its lines filled with what appeared to be dried blood mixed with pulverized bone. The geometric pattern was unlike anything in imperial records, its angles and proportions suggesting mathematical relationships that existed only in dimensions beyond normal human perception. Around the periphery of the carved symbol, additional bodies had been positioned with their limbs arranged to extend the pattern outward from its central focus. These corpses showed signs of having been alive during their positioning, restraint marks on wrists and ankles indicating they had struggled against their bonds before succumbing to whatever fate had been planned for them. The precision required to maintain the pattern while working with living subjects spoke of extensive practice and careful preparation. The chamber's walls bore extensive documentation of the ritual that had been conducted here, written in a mixture of Gothic and languages I did not recognize. The text described procedures for opening permanent gateways between dimensions, methods for anchoring demonic entities in physical reality, and techniques for ensuring that such manifestations would persist even after the death of their summoners. The implications were staggering. This facility had not been the site of a simple demon summoning, but rather a permanent breach in the barriers between realities. Evidence suggested that the ritual had been successful beyond its creator's wildest expectations. Scorch marks on the walls indicated that something of enormous power had manifested in the chamber, while structural damage to the surrounding areas spoke of forces that had tested the limits of the facility's construction. The fact that the carved symbol remained intact suggested that whatever had been summoned continued to draw power from this location, using it as an anchor point for ongoing manifestation in the physical universe. My exploration was interrupted by the detection of approaching signals on my portable AuSpex unit. The readings indicated a large vessel moving through the upper atmosphere, its trajectory suggesting a controlled descent toward the planet's surface. For a moment, hope flared in my chest as I considered the possibility that rescue had finally arrived, that someone had detected our distress signals and come to extract the survivors from this nightmare world. The vessel's approach was accompanied by automated Vox transmissions that initially seemed to confirm my optimistic assessment. Standard Imperial identification codes preceded recorded messages describing a medical evacuation mission dispatched to provide aid to stranded personnel. The transmission quality was excellent, free of the corruption that plagued local communications, and the content followed proper Imperial protocols for rescue operations. I made my way back to the surface with unprecedented speed, driven by the possibility that our ordeal was finally approaching its end. The other survivors had also detected the approaching vessel, and their reactions ranged from desperate joy to suspicious caution. Those still capable of coherent thought began preparing for evacuation, gathering what few possessions remained and attempting to present themselves as fit for transport despite their obvious psychological deterioration. The vessel became visible as it descended through the poisoned atmosphere, its hull gleaming with the distinctive lines of an Imperial Navy medical frigate. The ship's approach was textbook perfect, its pilot demonstrating the kind of skill that spoke of extensive training and experience. Landing thrusters fired in precise sequences as the vessel settled onto a cleared area several hundred meters from our position, its engines winding down with the familiar whine of properly maintained machinery. The first indication that something was wrong came when the ship's boarding ramp failed to deploy despite the completion of landing procedures. The vessel sat motionless on the scarred ground, its hull reflecting the sickly light of the twin suns while showing no signs of internal activity. Attempts to establish Vox contact with the crew met with automated responses that repeated the same evacuation protocols without variation or acknowledgement of our transmissions. My approach to the vessel revealed damage that had not been visible during its descent. La's burn scoring covered much of the hull, concentrated around what appeared to be defensive positions that had been hastily welded into place. Viewport glass had been replaced with armored plates, while weapon mounts showed signs of having been stripped of their contents. The ship bore the scars of prolonged combat, its pristine appearance from a distance giving way to evidence of desperate fighting at close range. The boarding ramp's manual release controls had been welded shut from the inside, effectively sealing the vessel's interior from external access. Cutting through the barriers required the use of our remaining plasma charges, precious resources that we could ill afford to expend on what was rapidly becoming a futile endeavor. The metalwork showed signs of having been performed under extreme stress, with rough welds and hastily applied reinforcements that spoke of panic rather than proper procedure. The ship's interior revealed a scene of systematic horror that surpassed even the worst discoveries I had made in the Underhive ruins. The crew had been dead for months, their bodies preserved by the vessel's environmental systems in states that told the story of their final hours. Evidence of fighting was everywhere. La's burns on bulkheads, blood spatters that had dried to brown stains, and improvised barricades that had been constructed from furniture and equipment. The medical bay contained the most disturbing discoveries, as the ship's complement of wounded personnel had been subjected to procedures that bore no resemblance to Imperial medical practice. Bodies had been opened, and their contents rearranged according to patterns that echoed the symbols I had found in the Underhive facility. The work showed the same meticulous attention to detail, the same artistic vision applied to human suffering, suggesting a connection between the planet's original corruption and whatever had befallen this rescue vessel. The ship's log entries provided a chronological account of the crew's descent into madness and violence. Initial reports described a routine evacuation mission that had proceeded according to standard protocols until the vessel entered the planet's atmosphere. Exposure to the corrupted environment had begun affecting the crew within hours of landing, with symptoms progressing from mild disorientation to complete psychological breakdown over the course of several days. The automated distress signals that had drawn my attention were part of a trap, a lure designed to attract additional victims to this cursed world. The ship's communication systems had been reprogrammed to broadcast false rescue transmissions, their messages carefully crafted to inspire hope in anyone desperate enough to believe them. The vessel itself had become another component of the planet's corruption, a monument to false hope that would continue broadcasting its lies until its power systems finally failed. The discovery that our supposed rescue was nothing more than an elaborate deception dealt a crushing blow to what remained of my companion's morale. Those who had maintained some semblance of sanity began exhibiting the same symptoms that had claimed their predecessors, while others retreated into catatonic states that offered temporary escape from an unbearable reality. The false hope had proven more damaging than honest despair, stripping away the psychological defenses that had allowed them to function despite impossible circumstances. My investigation of the corrupted vessel's navigation systems revealed coordinates for the source of the psychic emanations that had been growing stronger since my arrival on the planet. The readings pointed to a location deep beneath the surface, a sealed facility that predated the recent conflict by decades or possibly centuries. The psychic signature was unlike anything in Imperial records, suggesting the presence of something that had been imprisoned rather than summoned, something that was slowly working to free itself from whatever bonds held it in check. The coordinates led me to a reinforced bunker complex hidden beneath layers of debris and collapsed structures. The facility's construction was clearly Imperial in origin, though its design incorporated defensive measures that spoke of extreme paranoia about what was contained within. Multiple blast doors sealed the entrance, each one requiring separate authorization codes that had been scattered among different branches of the planetary government as a security precaution. The bunker's interior was a maze of corridors and chambers designed to confuse and delay anyone attempting to reach its central core. Automated defense systems had long since failed, their weapon mounts empty and their power cells drained, but the psychological effect of their presence remained. This was a place designed to contain something that its builders feared above all else, something that required constant vigilance and multiple layers of protection to keep safely imprisoned. The central chamber contained the source of the corruption that had consumed Mortis Tertius, a ritual circle that dwarfed even the elaborate construction I had discovered in the Underhive facility. The carved symbols covered every surface of the room, their lines glowing with a faint phosphorescence that pulsed in rhythm with something that might have been a heartbeat. The pattern was incomplete, missing key components that had prevented the full manifestation of whatever entity the original summoners had attempted to call forth. The incomplete nature of the ritual explained much about the planet's current condition. Rather than achieving a clean summoning that would have brought the demon fully into reality, the interrupted ceremony had created a permanent wound in the fabric of space-time. The entity remained partially manifested, existing in a state between dimensions that allowed it to influence the physical world while remaining safely beyond the reach of conventional weapons or banishment rituals. Documentation scattered throughout the chamber revealed that the original summoning had been conducted by planetary officials rather than chaos cultists, desperate men who had believed they could control powers beyond their understanding. The ritual had been intended as a weapon against an approaching Imperial compliance fleet, a last desperate attempt to preserve their independence through the invocation of demonic aid. Their hubris had doomed not only themselves, but every living thing on the planet's surface. The demon's influence had been growing steadily stronger over the years since the failed summoning, feeding on the psychic energy released by the suffering and death that had consumed the planet. Each act of violence, each moment of despair, each life extinguished in terror had provided additional power that the entity used to expand its influence and work toward completing the ritual that would grant it full manifestation in the physical universe. The realization that I was standing at the epicenter of a slowly expanding zone of corruption that would eventually consume entire sectors of space filled me with a horror that transcended personal fear. This was not simply a matter of individual survival, but a threat to the continued existence of human civilization itself. The demon's eventual escape from its dimensional prison would herald the beginning of an age of darkness that would make the current galactic conflict seem like minor skirmishes by comparison. The psychic emanations from the ritual chamber were growing stronger with each passing hour, their influence extending further across the planet's surface and into the surrounding void. The corruption that had claimed the rescue vessel was merely a preview of what awaited any ship unfortunate enough to enter the system, and the automated distress signals would continue to lure additional victims to feed the demon's growing power until someone found a way to complete the banishment that had been interrupted so many years before. The weight of the decision pressed down upon me like the crushing atmosphere of this damned world. Standing in that ritual chamber, surrounded by the pulsing glow of incomplete demon summoning circles, I understood that my choice would determine not just my own fate, but potentially the survival of countless imperial worlds. The psychic emanations from the carved symbols had grown so intense that my skull felt ready to split open, while whispers in languages that predated human civilization echoed through my thoughts with increasing clarity. My remaining companions had deteriorated beyond any hope of recovery during my absence. Returning to our makeshift stronghold, I found Corporal Vex methodically dismantling his own las gun, arranging the components in patterns that mirrored the symbols I had discovered in the underground facility. His movements were precise and deliberate, guided by knowledge he should not possess, while his eyes remained fixed on something visible only to him. The other survivors had gathered around him in a loose circle, swaying slightly as if responding to music that existed only in their corrupted minds. Sergeant Thorne's self-surgical experiments had progressed to the point where large sections of his torso lay open to the poisoned air, the wounds showing no signs of infection despite their obvious severity. He worked continuously with salvaged medical instruments, probing the exposed tissue while muttering observations about the changes he was documenting. The clinical detachment in his voice suggested that whatever remained of his original personality had been completely subsumed by the corruption that flowed through his veins like liquid madness. The sight of my former allies in their current state eliminated any lingering doubts about what needed to be done. They were no longer human in any meaningful sense, their bodies serving as vessels for something that wore their faces while pursuing its own incomprehensible agenda. Leaving them alive would accomplish nothing beyond prolonging their suffering, while potentially allowing the corruption to spread further through whatever rescue forces might eventually arrive. I made my preparations with the methodical care of a man who understood that failure was not an option. The remaining plasma charges from our equipment stores would provide enough destructive force to collapse the ritual chamber, though the explosion would almost certainly prove fatal to anyone in the immediate vicinity. The demon's anchor point in physical reality would be severed, forcing the entity back into the warp while sealing the dimensional breach that had poisoned this world for so many years. The journey back to the underground facility required careful timing to avoid the worst manifestations of corruption that plagued the surface during certain atmospheric conditions. The twin suns had aligned in a configuration that intensified the psychic emanations, causing reality distortions that made navigation treacherous even for someone familiar with the terrain. Shadows moved independently of their sources, while the ground itself seemed to pulse with a rhythm that matched the beating of some impossibly vast heart. My descent into the bunker complex was accompanied by increasingly violent psychic backlash as I approached the ritual chamber. The carved symbols blazed with phosphorescent fire that hurt to look at directly, while the whispers in my mind grew loud enough to drown out my own thoughts. Each step forward required tremendous effort as the demon's influence pressed against my consciousness, seeking cracks in my mental defenses that would allow it to establish a foothold in my soul. The entity's attempts at communication became more sophisticated as I entered the chamber, abandoning crude whispers in favor of complex psychological manipulation. Images flashed through my mind of the rescue that would never come, of the family I would never see again, of the meaningless nature of the sacrifice I was preparing to make. The demon offered alternatives, power beyond imagination, knowledge that would unlock the secrets of the universe, immortality that would allow me to witness the rise and fall of civilizations across the millennia. Setting the plasma charges required precise placement to ensure maximum structural damage while minimizing the risk of premature detonation. The ritual circle's geometric patterns had been carved deep into the chamber's foundation, their lines filled with substances that had fused into the stone through decades of psychic energy exposure. Destroying the symbols completely would require obliterating the entire chamber, bringing down thousands of tons of reinforced rockcrete, and permanently sealing the dimensional breach. The timer mechanisms on the plasma charges had been damaged by prolonged exposure to the planet's corrupted atmosphere, their displays flickering with readings that defied logical interpretation. I was forced to rely on manual detonation procedures, knowing that the explosion would consume everything within a radius that included my current position. The irony was not lost on me that my final act would mirror the sacrifice made by countless Imperial soldiers who had chosen death over corruption. As I completed the final connections, the psychic pressure in the chamber reached levels that threatened to crush my sanity entirely. The demon's presence became almost tangible, a weight that pressed against reality itself while seeking to force its way through the dimensional barriers that contained it. The carved symbols pulsed with increasing intensity, their glow casting shadows that moved with predatory intelligence, while the whispers in my mind became a roaring cacophony of alien voices. The entity made one final attempt to subvert my purpose, flooding my consciousness with visions of what would happen if I succeeded in my mission. I saw the planet's surface scoured clean by orbital bombardment, the corrupted atmosphere burned away by land strikes that reduced entire continents to molten glass. I witnessed the systematic extermination of anyone who had been exposed to the demon's influence, including potential rescue forces who would be classified as compromised simply by virtue of their proximity to this cursed world. The demon showed me the futility of individual resistance against forces that spanned galaxies and consumed civilizations like kindling. It revealed the true scope of chaos corruption throughout the Imperium, the countless worlds that had already fallen to influences similar to what plagued Mortis Tertius. My sacrifice would accomplish nothing more than delaying the inevitable, buying perhaps a few decades of ignorance before other dimensional breaches opened and the cycle repeated itself elsewhere. But the entity's psychological assault contained a fundamental flaw that revealed its alien nature. The demon could not comprehend the human capacity for defiance in the face of hopeless odds, the willingness to choose death over submission even when victory was impossible. Its offers of power and knowledge meant nothing to someone who had witnessed the true cost of such bargains, who had seen good men transformed into hollow shells that served purposes beyond their understanding. I triggered the detonation sequence with hands that shook from psychic pressure rather than fear. The plasma charges ignited in perfect synchronization, their combined energy release vaporizing the ritual chamber's contents while sending shock waves through the surrounding structure. The carved symbols disappeared in bursts of superheated gas that reached temperatures comparable to stellar cores, their destruction accompanied by a psychic scream that seemed to originate from dimensions beyond normal space-time. The demon's anchor point in physical reality snapped like an overstressed cable, the sudden severing of its connection sending feedback through the dimensional breach that had sustained it for so many years. The entity's presence retreated with the speed of something fleeing mortal injury, its influence over the planet's surface beginning to fade as the portal that had allowed its manifestation collapsed in upon itself. The bunker complex came apart around me with the grinding roar of failing structural supports, thousands of tons of reinforced construction materials crushing down into the space where the ritual chamber had existed moments before. The explosion's force propagated upward through the facility's multiple levels, triggering secondary collapses that would ensure the demon's prison remained permanently sealed beneath layers of twisted metal and pulverized stone. My consciousness fragmented as the psychic backlash from the demon's forced banishment tore through my mind like shrapnel from an exploding shell. Memories became confused with hallucinations, while my sense of individual identity began dissolving into the collective psychic residue left behind by the entity's prolonged presence on this world. I experienced flashes of the lives that had been consumed by the corruption, planetary officials who had thought they could control powers beyond their comprehension, PDF troopers who had executed civilians to prevent the spread of taint, rescue personnel who had arrived with hope only to find damnation. The physical destruction was mercifully brief, my body crushed by falling debris before the pain could register fully, but death did not bring the release I had expected. Instead of the Emperor's peace that awaited faithful servants, I found my consciousness trapped within the psychic matrix that had formed around the demon's former anchor point. The entity's banishment had created a void in local reality that drew in spiritual energy like a gravitational well, preventing the normal transition of souls into the warp. I became aware that I was not alone in this liminal space between life and death. The spirits of everyone who had died on Mortis Tertius during the years of corruption remained bound to the planet's surface, their souls unable to escape the psychic residue that permeated every particle of matter. We existed as a collective consciousness of the damned, witnesses to our own failure to prevent the catastrophe that had consumed our world. The demon's influence had not been completely eliminated by my sacrifice. Traces of its presence lingered in the planet's psychic atmosphere like radiation from a nuclear detonation, invisible but deadly to anyone with the sensitivity to detect them. These remnants would continue to affect anyone who landed on the surface, gradually wearing away their sanity while implanting suggestions that would eventually transform them into willing servants of chaos. My awareness expanded beyond the confines of my former physical existence, allowing me to perceive the full scope of the threat that Mortis Tertius represented to the wider galaxy. The automated distress signals from the corrupted rescue vessel continued to broadcast their false promises of salvation, while the planet's location along major shipping lanes ensured that additional vessels would eventually respond to the transmissions. Each new arrival would provide fresh souls to feed whatever corruption remained active beneath the surface. The realization that my sacrifice had accomplished nothing more than a temporary delay filled me with a despair that transcended anything I had experienced while still alive. The demon had been banished rather than destroyed, its essence scattered across dimensions where it would eventually reform and seek new opportunities for manifestation. The ritual chamber had been obliterated, but the knowledge of how to create similar summoning circles remained preserved in countless heretical texts throughout the galaxy. I understood now that I had become part of the planet's defense mechanisms, my consciousness bound to this cursed world for eternity. The psychic residue from my death had merged with the existing corruption, creating a barrier that would prevent the demon's immediate return while alerting me to any attempts at renewed summoning. I was condemned to serve as an unwilling guardian, forever vigilant against threats that would continue to emerge from the shadows of human ambition and alien malevolence. The irony of my situation was not lost on me. In trying to prevent others from suffering the fate that had claimed my companions, I had ensured that I would witness every moment of their inevitable corruption. Future rescue attempts would bring fresh victims to this nightmare world, and I would be powerless to warn them away from the dangers that awaited. I could only watch as good men and women repeated the same mistakes that had doomed everyone who had come before them. The Emperor's light seemed impossibly distant from this place where his prayers offered no comfort and his protection held no meaning. I had become something beyond redemption, neither fully alive nor properly dead, existing in a state that defied the natural order while serving purposes I could no longer comprehend. My consciousness would persist until the heat death of the universe, bearing witness to horrors that would make the current galactic conflicts seem like minor inconveniences by comparison. Mortis Tertius would remain a wound in reality, a permanent reminder of humanity's capacity for self-destruction when faced with powers beyond their understanding. The planet would continue to broadcast its false promises while consuming anyone foolish enough to believe them, adding their souls to the growing collection of the damned who served as its unwilling guardians. In the grim darkness of the far future, there was only war, and I had become another casualty in a conflict that would never end.